WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight is the season finale of the TV series Homicide. The series has been a critical success, but NBC is still undecided over whether to renew it. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with one of the stars of Homicide, Andre Brower. He plays Detective Frank Pemberton, a character prominently featured in tonight's episode. Our TV critic, David Bianculli, described Brower as the most compelling and potent dramatic actor on series television. Brower has also been praised for his work as a Shakespearean actor. I spoke with him last January, right after the episode in which Pemberton turned in his badge. He had bent the law to save the mayor's reputation at the request of the deputy police commissioner. But the commissioner later denied his own involvement and let the detective take the fall. In the final scene of that episode, Pemberton's partner tried to convince Pemberton to come back to the force.
What happened? Frank, you're not quitting. Come on.
Yes, I am.
What are you going to do, huh? You going to run security at a corporation off the Beltway? You going to teach crime detection technique at the police academy? Huh? You can't, Frank. You're a cop, and you will always be a cop.
Not anymore. In fact, I'm already relishing that moment tomorrow when the sun goes down and I haven't seen one dead person. That moment when my wife walks through the door and she gets to say, "Honey, I'm home." And I get to fix her a scotch and soda and ask her about her day. And actually, for once, listen and care as she relates every boring detail. I don't have a partner.
Get over it, Tim. I'm going home.
When you got the script in which you resigned under pressure, did you know for sure you'd be coming back the next episode and that you'd still have a part in the series?
Yeah, I was pretty confident about it. I didn't know which way the script was going to go, but I had no qualms about it. As a matter of fact, one of the writers, Jim Yashimura, came up to me on the street as I was walking toward the office, and he says, "I just want to assure you that there's nothing's going to happen to you, and you're not going to be off the show." And I had never dreamed that I'd be off the show, and they made me nervous with that talk. You know, when people come and reassure you that that you're safe, that's the time to begin worrying. I never had any qualms about Pemberton's resigning from the show, because I've always felt confident in my work. And I work well, and I do a good job. And so I felt that in the end, you know, hard work would pay off, and I'd still be on the show.
So when you get a script, you don't know what's happening to you in the next episode. Is that useful to you when you're playing, because you, the actor, and the character both don't know?
Well, my problem with not knowing where my character is going is the tendency sometimes to paint myself into a corner that I can't get out of. I remember early in the first three episodes of this year, I only had the first episode, and it was the beginning of Pemberton's religious angst, but I didn't know that. So consequently, I didn't play certain parts, certain scenes. I didn't play with a kind of a fervor or doubt or intensity that I needed, as a matter of fact. And writers would come up to me on a set and say, "I think you should play it this way. I think you should play it this way." And of course, I didn't know what they were talking about, and I couldn't see the justification. Now, of course, when I hear that a script will be in one, two, or three parts, I try to find out what the overarching idea or theme or journey for my character will be, so that I won't paint myself into a corner. I won't goof up in the elemental scene setting.
On Homicide, you have a different director each week.
Mm-hmm.
So does each director want to put their own touch on the character, and do you find that you have to assert yourself to maintain certain things about the character consistently from week to week?
Well, there are two things going on. The directors are all talented individuals, and they come in and they'd like to put their personal stamp on Homicide. But Homicide is a show that has its own theme, its own style, and it too constantly reinvents itself, but there are certain thematic elements which have to be maintained, and directors would like to change that, change the shooting style, film from odd, interesting, and quirky angles, and I don't think the show can really go overboard, you know what I mean, in mm-hmm. terms of changing, in terms of being innovative. Innovation almost killed us back in back in 1992. Pretty much, I know more about my character than my director does. I take suggestions and I work with my director, but I do know the fundamental aspects of my character, and I know how to maintain my character's integrity. Things change from week to week. The writers change their mind. I used to have kids. Now I don't have kids.
No, what happens in a transition like that?
Suddenly, I don't have kids. suddenly, it's just me and my wife, you know. I thought I had a son, but now I don't.
How did you realize you didn't have a son anymore?
Because in the script one day I saw there was a conversation between Pemberlin and Bayless, and in which Pemberlin says, my wife and I are thinking about having kids. And that's how I learned.
So did you go up to the writer and say, guess what? We've already got one?
Well, I have a picture of a child on my desk, as a matter of fact, who has always, as far as I've known, been my son. And now I don't know who that child is. He's my nephew or something. And it just changed right then and there. I don't think the memory of the viewer is very long. And also, not having a child allows for the development of having a child. It'll be another adventure. If you have children, you know what I mean about adventure.
You've done a fair amount of Shakespeare.
Oh, yeah, I love Shakespeare.
On stage.
Oh, yeah.
The way that a Shakespearean character uses English is different than the way a contemporary detective speaks. What can you learn from Shakespeare that you can apply to contemporary film and television in terms of speech? I don't mean making speeches, intonation...
All of that work came to me from the Juilliard School. Breaking up the sentences into understandable parts and putting them back together again. The pure technique of speaking in order to be understood through complex thoughts was taught to me at the Juilliard School. Shakespeare, of course, his thoughts are quite long and quite expressive and quite complex. And the actor is forced to think through the line from beginning to end. And it, as opposed to modern speech, modern, I guess you could call it that. It's not broken down into short fragments, but rather longer and more subtle thoughts. So consequently, when I go over to Homicide, when I get a long sentence, I break it down into its component parts, and I use the entire sentence, you know.
Is there any way I could get you to take a line from Shakespeare or to take a long sentence from Homicide and show us how you break it down and how you actually analyze that line before delivering it?
I don't have a script in front of me. Let me think. So we're looking for a van that, I can't remember the line. We're looking for a van that does not exist, which carried kidnappers who never lived, which did not abscond with U.S. congressmen, and then didn't drop them off here. So the line, I think I got the line. So we're looking for a van which does not exist, which carried kidnappers who never lived, which did not abscond with a U.S. congressman and then didn't drop them off here, I guess, is what the other character responds. Now, that's a that's a long and complicated thought, which you typically don't get. Typically, it's like, where is this guy? Or these kidnappers don't exist, or some smaller thought. And I relish the idea of taking a long thought, breaking it down to its component parts, putting it back together again, and being able to deliver it in one breath from beginning to end, and have it end up sounding like a question that I actually asked and have made my own, rather than sounding like a newspaper clipping or something to that effect.
My guest is Andre Brower. He plays Detective Frank Pemberlin on the TV series Homicide. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Andre Brower, one of the stars of the TV series Homicide. Let's get to your formative years. You grew up in Chicago. What was the neighborhood?
The first neighborhood was called Austin. I spent from 62 to 78 or 79 there. And then we moved to an area which whose name eludes me, but it's very near the corner of Pulaski and Roosevelt Road, in Chicago. And I stayed there until I went to college. So it's about 2 years over in that neighborhood, which is very depressed. Then I went to school in California. Then I went to school in New York, and then I started my career.
I read that your grandmother taught you how to read before you even started school. What do you remember about that?
About my grandma?
Well, about her teaching you to read.
Well, she read from the Bible, you know. She was a very, very religious woman. The sweetest woman I've ever known. And she would read to me from the Bible, and I'd look it up, and I'd keep reading with her. So when I got to first grade with the C. Dick Run and C. Jane Run stuff, I knew it already, you know. And I remember being, I guess, in third grade at a school called Spencer, which is over in my old neighborhood in Austin. And I could read so well that the teacher no longer called on me. So I remember going home one day and I told my father, I said, Daddy, they won't let me read. And he said, what do you mean? He says, well, when we sit in a circle and everybody else reads, I raise my hand and the teacher doesn't call on me. And, you know, I never saw that school ever again. The next day I was in St. Thomas Aquinas, a Catholic school right around the corner. I didn't clean out my locker. I didn't clean out my desk. I didn't take my pencils away. My father figured way back in then, it must have been 1969, that education is life, you know, and without an education, you really can't make anything of your life. And he was a man who even today, he does not fool around. He makes decisions based upon, you know, his future goals and his future needs, and he acts upon them immediately. So I remember the most impressive thing about my father is he decided in that instant that his son was not going to be in a school where they did not let him read, and I was moved the very next day.
You said before you loved Shakespeare even when you were young. What did you find when you were young in Shakespeare? A lot of young people don't like Shakespeare because it's such a different period and because the language can be very difficult to understand compared to contemporary writing.
This is my impression, that if your vocabulary is limited, then your thoughts are limited. And I'm not a man who wants to be limited, and I found something really, really beautiful in Shakespeare, something very spiritual and lovely in Shakespeare, and I'm not willing to give it up. I'd like to feel the kinds of feelings that Laertes feels upon hearing about the death of his sister, you know, or when he sees his sister mad with flowers in her hair and talking outrageous gibberish and acting her behavior, acting with an incredible kind of sexual license that he's never seen her act with. He says simply, "Oh God, do you see this?" Now, a lot of people would say, what's wrong with her? Let's get her to a doctor. They try to solve the problem. They do a lot of different things. But Laertes is a very spiritual man. And he looks up and he says, "Oh God, do you see this?" It's a crime against nature in a certain way, you know. And his strange love for his sister is expressed in this way. And it can't be beat. It can't be beat by cop shows, and it can't be beat by the most interesting kind of television drama. Shakespeare lives, and his characters express the deepest parts of themselves. Pembleton doesn't express the deepest part of himself, you know. There's so many chameleon-like layers and aspects to Pembleton's behavior and his speech and his relationships with everyone else. But in Shakespeare, I find the opportunity to really glimpse the most elemental and human part of a person.
I want to get back to Catholic school. When your parents decided that you're going to go to Catholic school right away, did you thrive there? Did you like it? Were there things that you didn't like about the discipline or the uniform you had to wear?
The uniform, the blue pants, and oh my goodness. things that I didn't like about the Catholic school. No, I actually loved it. You know, it was a very challenging environment. And I thrived in that kind of environment. I thrived with that kind of discipline. Not because I believe that rules were made to be broken, but I enjoy structure in my life. That same sort of discipline makes me sit at home and really break down a script into all its intimate characteristics so that I can do the best kind of work when I get to the set, so that I learn my lines before I get there, you know, and I ask questions before I get there, before I get to the set, and I look for changes a couple of days before by calling the writers and discussing aspects of the character or the script before, so that things aren't left left to chance. I love to rehearse. Homicide is not a show in which we get rehearsal before we begin the film. But in all the best work that I've seen myself do on television, and I see a lot of flaws in my own work, the best part of my work is always involved rehearsal. I remember back in 1992 when we did Three Men and Adina with Moses Gunn and Kyle Secor and myself.
This
in the
was
box.
The interrogation episode.
The interrogation episode. We rehearsed every day 2 hours before we started shooting.
That was a great episode.
The homework we did in rehearsal showed up on screen.
What kind of homework did you do?
We would actually run through the lines, and we made choices right then and there. We rehearsed like as if we were doing a play. We found the best choice, not the first choice. We found the best choice, and I love the work that way. Back in 1993, Isaiah Washington, who was the kid in that episode Black and Blue, the kid who's who I get a confession out of, although I know he's innocent. We rehearsed the day before that. And that made that episode, that interrogation, so much better for me, is because I was no longer worried or filled with anxiety about what I might do, what choices would be best. And consequently, when we got to the set and we had to do, we chose to do 8.5 pages, maybe 9.5 pages, in one take, I knew what I was doing from beginning to end.
When you were young, was it easy for you to find friends who were as serious about education and about other aspects of life as you were?
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You could find the athletes and the jokers and the scamps and the rascals. You could find everybody, anywhere you'd look for them. I've been gifted by God to be able to take tests well. Who knows what I know? But if you give me a number two pencil, uh-huh. If you give me a number two pencil with multiple choices, I can just run roughshod over that test and make very, very high scores. I remember I went out to Stanford University, and based upon my PSATs, my SATs, and my ACTs, I guess those are the standardized tests, I scored these super high scores, and I'd learned my lesson, and I've been graced by God with the ability to hear things and remember them in tremendous detail. I rarely took notes in class. I simply remembered what I was told and regurgitated it, you might say. So consequently, my education has been characterized by very, very high test scores and very high grades. And school has always been rather easy for me. Grad school was the hardest challenge I've ever had in my life because it's not about tests. It's about what kind of person you are. I went to Juilliard School as a very naive young man, full of myself. And I was exposed to, I was a member of a class with 22 fine actors. And I had to look down inside myself and find out what kind of person I was. I lost my mind several times at the Juilliard School. I was reduced to tears on many occasions. And I fought back to be this kind of man.
When you were reduced to tears, was that during a rehearsal or, you know, in class?
No.
In front of other people?
No, I remember my woman who I love and respect today, Liz Smith, my voice teacher. We were doing some poems by Dylan Thomas. I was doing Dylan Thomas, And Death Shall Have No Dominion. And I had worked so hard to improve my speech and my posture and my voice and the tonal production and all these different things. And I did that poem, and I thought I'd done quite well. And she looked at me, and she looked at me for a long time, about 15, 20 seconds after I'd done it. So I was saying, well, does she like it? Does she not like it? And she says, it was very, very well spoken, and your voice is improving tremendously, but it's rather boring, isn't it? And she looked around the room, and she looked for the assent of my classmates. She says, it's very, very, very boring. I didn't see any of Andre Brower in that. She called me Andre, as a matter of fact, Andre Brower. I didn't see any of Andre in that, and so I want you to do it again. Well, I was humiliated by that. I had tried my hardest, and I'd done my best to master the technical aspects of acting, and she was asking for me. She was asking for me to show myself, to show what kind of person I was and how I interpreted things. And she was asking me, do you know anything about being a human being? And I was reduced to tears by that, because I now knew that instead of faking my way through acting, you know, by perfecting the technical aspects of this profession, this craft, I would have to put something of Andre Brower in this, you know.
So where did you take it after that? Were you able to do it right afterwards, or were you really humiliated by the whole thing?
I was humiliated by the whole thing, you know, and through my tears, I redid the speech again. And then she said, and of course, everything went awry, you know, that everything was bad. And she said at the end of that, she said, now that was interesting, you know, and I could have taken the wrong aspect. I could have taken the wrong lesson from what she was trying to tell me and created a very showy aspect of my personality or a fake humanism. But I think she wanted to see Andre Brower, because that's really the only reason that we work in this profession, to show not who we are in a very egotistical manner. This is me, and let me go on radio stations and let me talk to magazines and tell them all about Andre Brower. What she was suggesting is that there is a very human part to me, and that I must show it in order to earn my keep in this craft, in this profession. That there's no point. There's nothing really wonderful about Andre Brower, who has mastered the technique yet refuses to show himself.
Andre Brower, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
Andre Brower plays Detective Frank Pembleton on the TV series Homicide. You can see him tonight on the season finale. Our interview was recorded last January. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.